Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This is G.R. Mobley. This show is sponsored by Mobius Strip Press. If you go to MobiusStripPress.com, you can find out how you can download these podcasts and find our support documents and links. As a reminder, this is an educational grassroots program designed to restoring our Constitution. Many parts of these shows will refer to previous shows, and these shows build off of each other. That said, you'll need to listen to all of these shows to garner what Republic Review is and how we can reclaim the Republic. Today is the 7th of December, and this is the anniversary, excuse me. My tongue gets tied when I do this. Anyway, this is the anniversary of when our Republic was attacked by Japan in 1941. What we call Pearl Harbor Day was a significant turning point in our constitutional history. As a macro historian, I always try to look at the big picture. Consequently, FDR needed an attack on the U.S. to get us into war. There's plenty of books that expose this. There's plenty of empirical data that talks about why FDR harassed and basically taunted the Japanese and the Germans to try to get us to get them to attack us. The entire world at this point in time was adopting communistic ideologies since the last World War that Woodrow Wilson got us into. And here in America, the U.S. was on socialism steroids. Again, this is during FDR's time. And those socialism steroids, known as the New Deal, to inch us closer towards communism, was on this unstoppable path until these two deviants kind of upset the communist apple cart towards the end of the 30s. This is when Hitler in Germany rose and adopted a fascist form of communism. Most people like to think that the Nazis were on the right side of politics, but actually they were on the far left, because the first thing that Hitler did was he disbanded the Republic and nationalized everything. He started nationalizing medicine, and he actually nationalized religion. He was a huge communist in nationalizing things. But anyway, he was on conquest to take over Europe. The other deviant was Japan. They were a lot different, though. This was an empire seeking conquest and broadening their empire. They weren't necessarily looking for a communist form of government. To the elitists in the 30s, and actually the elitists over time, who were trying to propel the world into the Woodrow Wilson's failed fantasy, known as the League of Nations and global governance, they needed stability to begin bringing all countries into a world banking forum. Let me take a quick aside. Just like what was going on with Europe and trying to create the euro and the economic union of Europe, they needed stability. So we, as a matter of fact, under President Clinton, he injected forces to go in there to help stabilize and help entrench Islam into a good entry point into Europe. And so, this is all a part of the big progressive push and the big progressive move towards global governance. But anyway, let me get back to my train of thought. Here's another aside. One may want to look up the Venona Project and the global banking of the time. And we're talking about the global banking efforts of the 40s and even the 30s and so forth. If you go back to Jekyll Island and the Federal Reserve and what the Rothschilds and the Rothschild banking system was trying to create, they were definitely moving towards a global bank and trying to create a global finance and global governance. It's kind of like all the utopian books coming true. Well, anyway, even though many of these big countries were already moving towards or into these global banks, there were the rest that needed to be brought in, and that's why they needed the stability. Anyway, from the global depression, because when we went into the collapse of 1929, the global depression, you know, it wasn't just a U.S. depression. Germany was in the throes of depression. Theirs was different. But everybody was in the throes of depression. Even Russia, Stalin starved millions of people because they couldn't grow food, or the way they were managing the pricing and production, he was killing people. So there was a lot of oppression and depression going on in the 30s going into the 40s. So these two despots, these two deviants, exploited the opportunity and sought to expand their empires and or their boundaries. FDR and the world's elite felt it paramount that we enter the war. They did not believe Russia alone could win a dual front war. So FDR harassed, as we know, and I've said before, that he harassed both Germany and Japan to attack. And he got what he needed, thus today's anniversary. So I'll let the annals of history kind of report this. And there's all sorts of really good books. One of my favorite is an obscure one called The Unseen Hand. Or you could read my book. I talk about it, but I really don't get into the histories of wars. I get more into the ideology and the macro perspective. More importantly, FDR was able to give communism a test run here in the U.S. And I don't think most people are aware of the fact that we were living under a fascist and a communistic state. Now, it wasn't hard fascism. But the fact is that what FDR did was an egregious violation to the Constitution when he took us into the war. If you know someone who went through and lived through World War II and they can remember, in other words, they don't have Alzheimer's or what have you, they actually have cognitive abilities, you may want to ask them what it was like here in the United States. Ask your parents, maybe, or your grandparents or your great-grandparents about ration cards. Ask them about products not being available, such as tires, cars. I mean, just fundamental products that, you know, we would consider fundamental today. Or, as I said, food and so forth. Ask them about the propaganda patrols at the theaters and the public events and how the news was controlled and distributed. You can also ask them about the Blue Eagle and what that represented during that depression and during the war time frame when FDR ramped up his globalist, or not his globalist, but his communist testing here in the United States. Americans surrendered their rights and privileges, freedoms, and their liberty because we were attacked. It is interesting what we're willing to do when we are reduced to primal emotions such as fear and anger. As long as a barrage of asides, as long as I'm talking about this, I've got this barrage of asides on the rations and confiscations and so forth. And so if you think about it, and I'll take this little tangent here, what is the free market? Most people go, well, that's what we have today. Actually, no, the free market is where, and actually during FDR's time, the free market was forced to come out, and it was what we would call today the black market. What we have today in our market space is a heavily regulated market that, you know, has everybody's fingers in your pocket, from the U.S., government, our general government, to the states, to the counties and local and so forth. Everybody has their fingers in your pocket to some degree in trying to make some money so that they can govern us better. Bottom line, that's our market today. But during FDR's time and this barrage of asides, if we just look at the rations, nobody could just go out and buy beef. Nobody could just go and buy sugar, butter, what we would consider staples, flour and so forth. What would happen is you were allowed to only buy so much for a certain period of time, and then you couldn't buy anymore. And the retailers, or I should say the grocery stores or the merchants, they held that line because if they got caught, they would get in trouble. They would literally, they'd not just get in trouble. They wouldn't get their hands spanked. They would literally go to jail. And it was not tolerated and zero tolerance policy towards anybody that violated these policies, or I should say these cards, these ration cards. There was this confiscation of production and services. Ask them about this. There was literally a period of time for a couple of years you couldn't even buy a car. The car manufacturers stopped producing cars for people because they were directed by the government and their means of production was seized just so that they could ramp up the mass production of our armaments to fight the war. Even if a company wanted to use resources to sell cars and what have you, they were not allowed. In addition, there was a confiscation of services. And the Blue Eagle was the representation of government compliance. In other words, if you ran a store and you were selling products or a service, and your products were matching what the government dictated that service or good should talk about. So remember, a free market, the price is based on supply and demand. Well, at this point in time, the prices were set by government. Well, one of my favorite songs, it's in my ear. I need to take a hard break. So let's come right back to this and I'll talk about the Blue Eagle after the break. Thank you. Okay, so we're back. Back on my barrage of asides here. On the Blue Eagle, there were plenty of cases. And as a matter of fact, a really good book I'd recommend anybody read. And if you go to my recommended reads, I believe it's on there. It's by Jonah Goldberg, and it's about fascism. I forget the name of the book, but anyway, Jonah Goldberg wrote it. And he talks about the Blue Eagle. And I remember other cases where people were arrested because they were non-compliant. And as a matter of fact, an example he gives that I want to repeat here is that there was a dry cleaner laundry business. And this guy felt that he was charging too much for ironing, cleaning, and, you know, taking care of somebody's pants and what the government stated the cost of cleaning and pressing would be. And so he was charging less and he was turned in and arrested for undercutting the stated government market price and thrown in jail. So it was a very confiscatory or a very tyrannic government at that point in time under FDR. I also remember the stories of, you know, my family where they had squirreled away holes and cubby points that, you know, were hidden so that when people would come by to inspect or if the sheriff or somebody came by, they wouldn't find that they were hoarding sugar or what have you. Because you got to remember that back in the 30s, a lot of people were still growing their own food. That was a bad thing because that means you could bypass, you know, the production of butter if you made it yourself. You could bypass the, you know, the store in wheat, flour, and the staples if you lived out in the country. And the term victory farms came from that era where people would have their own little patch of food. And in some respects, some of that was allowed, some of it wasn't. And it was very interesting how iron-fisted we became as a government. And again, like I said earlier, it's very interesting how we're willing to surrender and not stand up. And what the states at that point should have stood up and said, you don't have this power and authority. Okay, so we're in a war, but you can't start dictating the cost of food and the cost of services. He definitely overreached his constitutional boundaries. And everybody agrees with that. But back to the Blue Eagle. The Blue Eagle ended up becoming this national symbol. And guess what? Football team chose to use it for their logo. That's right, Philadelphia. And so when you look at Philadelphia and you see their old or you see their symbol or their what do you call that, logo, then you can just think of the old tyrannical government. And that's the symbol that they used. Anyway, let's take another long barrage or another part of this long barrage of asides and take a look at the predecessors to FDR who helped set him up to being able to step on the Constitution. As a matter of fact, you got to remember that the old adage on the boiling pot and the frog, that if you throw a frog into hot water, then they're going to jump right out. But if you slowly heat the water up, they will lose their ability and their muscles will become jelly and you'll be able to cook them and eat them if you eat frogs. But if you look at the predecessors that helped set up Teddy, or I should say FDR, I think it goes to his uncle Teddy or cousin, I forget the relationship, but Teddy was the first to really step on the Constitution, and he wasn't very happy when he realized that he missed the whole communist movement that went into the Ivy League because he graduated from Harvard. And the Fabian Society came into Harvard after he had graduated. So he missed this great enlightenment in his education. And so he was determined to ensure that he embraced that. And he started utilizing his position as the president when McKinley was assassinated and he took over. He used his position to start stepping on corporations to help start setting the tone that corporations were evil and bad, and help start setting the tone that the government could do anything they needed to do, that they were here for you. You know the old adage, we're from the government and we're here to help. Anyway, Teddy was followed on by Taft, and Taft was a progressive. All these guys were progressives. They may have been Republicans, but they were progressives. And Taft was just not progressive enough for Teddy. So when Taft came up for his reelection, what did end up happening was Teddy says, well, you know what, because you're not going to be progressive enough, I'm going to run. And he ran as a third party ticket and basically gave Wilson, who was even more progressive, and Teddy knew this, and he helped basically seal the deal for Wilson. Very similar thing happened against Bush with Perot and Clinton. When Perot stepped in, he made sure that Clinton would be elected. And by the way, when you look at these elections with Teddy, Taft, and Wilson, same thing with Bush, Clinton, and Perot, Clinton only won with 39% of the vote. I forget how much Wilson, but he didn't get a majority of the vote either. They needed that third party to get that true progressive to get us towards this new world. And that new world was that League of Nations and that that brain trust that Woodrow Wilson wanted to harvest out of the world and out of the United States. And his globalist dream, truly, I believe Woodrow Wilson's globalist dream was discarding our Constitution. During his tenure as president, I believe Upton Sinclair, who was a card-carrying communist in Los Angeles, was arrested in public for reading the Constitution. And the arresting officer said, we don't need you reading the Constitution. So that's just how far off and how far we had drifted away from the understanding of what our Constitution was at that point in time. And there was a resurgent after Teddy or after Wilson's tenure when we got Hardy. Hardy was still a progressive. And as a matter of fact, a lot of things really didn't necessarily change, you know, back. What ended up happening was Hardy died in office and Coolidge took over. And Coolidge happened to be one guy that was a lawyer and he studied the Constitution and he understood it. And that's one of the reasons why, you know, he vetoed a lot of bills because he knew that they were overstepping their bounds. However, he was a progressive. He wanted a lot of these progressive things to move forward, but he still wanted to follow the Constitution. So another real interesting little history tidbit for you is if you do the research, you'll find in 1926, he actually signed the bill that was an amendment to go to the states in granting the federal government the ability to create the Department of Labor. Now, it was all under the guise that the federal government could regulate child labor, but go read it, and that actually failed because the state said, no way, we're not letting you regulate labor. That is ours, and that we're not going to surrender or delegate that power to you. By the way, with the Department of Labor today, we still don't have that amendment, so how did they get that power? Yep, usurpation. Anyway, so Coolidge and his deviations back to applying constitutional principles, getting away from what was going on with Teddy, Taft, Wilson, and Hardy, he, you know, tried to adhere to the Constitution. That's why he signed that that amendment. But Hoover, who followed him, Hoover was not, how do I say this? Coolidge was not a fan, and he was not a bright light in Coolidge's eyes. As a matter of fact, he was very lukewarm on Hoover, and Coolidge didn't say any disparaging things because he was really a high road kind of guy. But having just lost his son and deciding not to run for election, he basically stepped aside and let Hoover or whatever pan out from the party bosses and so forth give us our next president, and Hoover stepped in. Just to understand who Hoover was, he was appointed, and he, even though he was a card-carrying Republican, and just like Teddy and just like Taft, he was a huge progressive, and he loved working for Wilson, and he actually wrote Wilson's biography. He was his secretary to the U.S. Food Administration, and later on, Hoover became the Secretary of Commerce. The New Deal was given to us by Hoover after the Great Depression. Again, in a macro view, if we look at Reagan today, we appear to be in a repetitive cycle that continues to push us towards this progressive agenda and global governance. Therefore, whether Trump will show the progressive push or hurl us onto a new course of no return, no one knows except the Lord. I will say this. If we, as the ultimate stakeholders of the Constitution, do not begin to act and resist federal tyranny, my concept of republic review, we will lose our individual liberty and sovereignty. Whether it is another December 7th or another 9/11, a financial collapse from unconstitutional spending, or another civil war, I'm telling you, if we act, we can reverse our course. If you read my executive summary on Facebook called The Irrefutable Argument for Republic Review, then I think you'll garner what I'm talking about and what, you know, what constitutional powers we have. I have had very few who have read this that are constitutional scholars, and they've all agreed, and only a few people kind of question that. So I ask for your support, and if you're not convinced, stay tuned and keep listening to this show. I believe you'll ultimately agree, and I hope before it's too late, you'll agree. Anyway, that said, I hear the music. Let's not give the powers to these guys. God bless, and we'll talk to you next week. Thank you very much.